to a low crouch and bolted towards the back hallway, his wet feet slapping the linoleum. He didn't take time to look back. Whatever was going down in this room, Gentry had no intention of getting in the middle of it with no firearm and no idea who the players were. The door jammed to the hallway, splintered with a burst of submachine gun fire just a step in front of Gentry's face. He ran right at it, through the overpressure of the supersonic ammo and the flying splinters, down into the dark hall and to the bathroom where he'd shaved an hour and a half earlier. He ducked in quickly for his backpack and threw it over a shoulder. Wearing only his underwear and a bandage on his thigh, he sprinted into a small bedroom at the end of the hall. Over the low twin bed was a window with a thin wire grating. He shattered the glass with a metal end table, lifted the mattress, and pushed it over the windowsill to cover any remaining shards, then rolled out over it into a small courtyard. A door to the building behind Laszlo's was locked, so Court ran to the far corner of the courtyard. He used iron security bars over a first-story window to climb his way to a second-story balcony where, after four or five tentative kicks from his left heel, he finally shattered a glass window. Loud snaps of gunfire continued below and behind him. He took care to avoid the broken glass left in the pane as he stepped through the window, but as he climbed into the apartment, he cut both his feet stepping in on the carpet. He cried out in pain, fell to his knees, and cut them too. Crab walking through the small bedroom, he finally stood, hobbled into the bathroom, and rifled through the medicine cabinet. A few seconds later, he sat on the toilet and dressed his fresh injuries. His right foot was okay, a little jab that he poured antiseptic into and wrapped with toilet paper. The ball of his left foot was much worse. It was a relatively deep puncture. He washed it quickly and cinched a hand towel tight around it to stanch the bleeding. It needed stitches, but Court knew he wouldn't be getting stitches anytime soon. Similar to his feet, his left knee was okay, but his right was badly injured. With a wince, he pulled a shard of glass from his skin, an unlucky barb at the end hooked on his flesh as he removed it. Blood ran down to the floor. Fuck! He groaned as he cleaned and dressed the gash as best he could. 3 minutes later, he realized the shooting had died down across the courtyard. He heard sirens, shouting, a baby crying in the next apartment, woken from its nap by the activity. He'd thought the apartment was empty, but when he walked into the living room, still just in his wet boxers, but now with wrapped feet and knees, he found an elderly lady sitting alone on a couch. She looked at him with eyes unafraid, bright and piercing and blue. He put a hand out to calm her, but lowered it slowly. "I won't hurt you," he said, but he doubted she understood. He mimicked pulling on pants, and she slowly pointed to a room down the hall. There he found men's clothes. A dead husband, maybe? No, a son away at work. He found blue coveralls and climbed into them, and heavy steel-toed boots that were too big but serviceable with two pairs of white socks. Gentry thanked the lady with a bow and a smile. She nodded back, slowly. He pulled a wad of euros from his backpack and laid them on a table. The old woman said something he did not understand, and with another bow, he was out the door to the second-floor hallway. Injured, unarmed, with neither means of transportation nor the documents he came all the way to Budapest to acquire. Court Gentry stepped outside and into a steady rain. He looked down to his watch. It was 5 in the afternoon, 8 and 1/2 hours since beginning his journey. He seemed so much farther away now than when he started. At Laurent Group's London office, Lloyd and Fitzroy waited for the news of the Indonesians. It came after 4 p.m., but not from the team itself. Sir Donald's phone rang. It was Gentry.
"Cheltenham?
It's me." Fitzroy had to compose himself before speaking. Finally, he said,
"Thank God! You've gotten clear of Sabo?"
"Yeah, just."
"What happened?"
"Not sure. Sounded like an SAD field team showed up. Sabo must have had some personal security, and it went loud." Lloyd and Fitzroy stared at one another.
"Ah, right. Understood. How are you?
Surviving.
Where are you now?
Still in Budapest. Both Lloyd and Fitzroy looked over to the tech. His head leaned over a computer terminal, but he bobbed it up and down, confirming the truthfulness of the target by pinpointing the cell tower the phone was using.
What now?
Asked Fitzroy. The question was as much to the American on his right as it was to the American on the other end of the line.
I head west. Everything's still on track. Do you have any more information for me?
Yes. The men you met this morning in Prague were Albanians. Simple mercenaries. Hired by Nigerian Secret Service.
They've probably contracted a new team by now. Any idea what I'm up against?
Hard to say, son. I'm working on it.
What do you know about the enemy force structure around your family?
4 or 5 Nigerian secret police types. Not tier 1 gunmen by any stretch, though they have my family scared witless.
As I get closer, I'll need the exact location.
Aye. You'll be there by tomorrow morning?
No. I have a stop to make first.
Not another dangerous detour, I hope?
No. This one is on the way.
Fitzroy hesitated, then said,
Right. Anything else you need from me?
Anything else? What have you given me so far? Look, you are my handler. Handle something. I need to know if I'm going to run into any more goons along my route. I need to know how the fucking Nigerians found out my name, found out about you. There is something very screwed up here, and I need as much of it figured out as possible before I get to Normandy.
I understand. I am working on it.
Have you had any more contact with the kidnappers?
Sporadically. They think I'm turning over every rock to find you. I'm calling everyone along my network. Just to make it look good, you know.
Keep it up. I'll stay away from the network. Call me if you learn anything.
The line went dead. Within 2 minutes, Fitzroy and Lloyd had more of an explanation about what had happened. Regal called, and between the three of them, they managed to put the pieces together. The 6 Indonesians had been completely wiped out, all dead. The CIA had torched the building to cover their tracks. It was unknown if the agency had taken casualties. Sabo was dead, and Gentry had used another of his 9 lives, but had gotten free.
So, where is he now?
Asked Regal.
Heading west from Budapest.
Via train, car, motorcycle?
We don't know. He called us from a cell phone. He'd apparently pulled it off a passerby, dumped it just after he hung up.
Anything else to report?
Asked Kurt Regal.
Lloyd barked into the phone angrily. You report to me, Regal. What happened to your shit-hot Indonesian Kopassus commandos? I thought you said Gentry would be no match for them.
Gentry didn't kill them. CIA paramilitaries did. Look, Lloyd, we knew the gray man would have some resiliency. My plan all along was for 1 or 2 teams to knock him off balance, get him reactive instead of proactive. That way, he'll stumble into the next team unprepared.
Lloyd said, We have 10 more teams lying in wait for him. I want him dead before the night is through.
Then we agree on something.
Regal rang off. Lloyd then turned his attention to the Englishman. A pained expression flashed on the older man's face.
What is it?
Fitzroy's anguish was unrelenting.
What's wrong?
I believe he told me something. He didn't mean to tell me, but I sussed it out.
Lloyd sat up. The few wrinkles in his pinstripe suit smoothed out with the movement.
What? What did he tell you?
I know where he's going.
The young American attorney's face slowly widened into a smile.
Excellent.
He reached for his mobile phone.
Where?
There's a catch. This place he's going, only 3 blokes have ever known about it. One of those blokes is dead. One of those blokes is the gray man. And one of those blokes is me. I'll tell you where, but if your little reality show contest doesn't destroy him there, he's going to know I've set him up. Your chaps miss him this time. and it's game over.
Let me worry about that. Tell me where he's going.
Graubünden.
Where the fuck is that?
Chapter 16. Song Park Kim had sat motionless in a meditative state while airborne, but his eyes opened, awake and alert, upon touchdown at Charles de Gaulle Airport. The only passenger of the Falcon 50 executive jet, his small, rough hands rested on his knees, and his eyes remained hidden behind stylish sunglasses. His perfectly tailored pinstripe suit fit his environment precisely. The cabin was appointed for executive travel, and he appeared to be a youngish but otherwise unremarkable Asian executive. The Falcon taxied off the runway, down and off the taxiway, past a long row of parked corporate jets, finally turning into an open hangar door. A waiting limousine, still wet from the drizzle of the gray evening, idled in the middle of the hangar. A driver stood alongside. As soon as the jet came to a complete stop and the turbine slowed, the co-pilot made his way back to the 7-seat cabin carrying a nylon gym bag. He sat in front of Song Park Kim and lowered the bag onto a mahogany table between them. Kim said nothing.
I was told to give you this upon touchdown. Immigration has been dealt with. No customs problems. There is a car waiting for you.
A curt nod, nearly imperceptible, from the short-haired Korean.
Enjoy Paris, sir,
said the co-pilot. He stood and retreated to the cockpit. The small partition closed behind him. Alone, Song Park unzipped the bag, pulled out a Heckler & Koch MP7A1 machine pistol. He ignored the telescoping stock and held the weapon like a handgun out in front of him, looking through the gun's simple sight system. 2 long, thin magazines, each filled with 20 4.6 by 30 millimeter hollow-point cartridges, were attached to one another by means of a nylon cinch. He replaced the weapon in the bag. Next, he pulled out a mobile phone and an earpiece. He tucked the earpiece in place on the side of his head and turned it on. The phone he also turned on before slipping it into his coat pocket. A handheld GPS receiver went into another pocket. More MP7 magazines, a suppressor, and a change of clothes remained in the bag untouched. A black-handled, black-bladed folding knife emerged from the bag, and he slipped this into his pocket. 2 minutes later, he sat in the limousine. The driver looked straight ahead as Kim said,
City Center.
The limo rolled forward towards the hangar doors. Kim was South Korean, an assassin with the National Intelligence Service. He was their best. 5 wet jobs inside North Korea, most of them with no support whatsoever, had built a legend for him in his unit. 7 more operations in China against North Korean sanctions violators, 2 in Russia against purveyors of nuclear secrets, and a few hits on fellow South Koreans in need of permanent attitude adjustments vis-a-vis their nefarious northern neighbors had made Song Park Kim, at 32, the obvious choice when his leaders were asked to furnish a killer to send to Paris to hunt a killer in exchange for cold, hard cash. Kim did not voice opinions on his assignments. Working alone, he had no one to voice them to. But were his thoughts solicited, he would have said this mission smelled rotten to the core. $20 million for the head of the Gray Man, a former CIA operative who, he'd heard through the grapevine, had not deserved the sellout he had gotten from his masters. The $20 million was being offered by some European corporation. This was nothing like the nationalistic operations Kim worked throughout his career. Still, Kim knew he was an instrument of South Korea's domestic and foreign policy. His counsel had not been sought, and those whose judgment was valued had decided he should come here to Paris, settle in, wait for a call giving him the Gray Man's whereabouts, and then pour hot bullets into the poor bastard's back. Graubünden is an eastern canton of Switzerland, tucked into a little niche near where the southwestern Austrian border concaves. It is known as the Canton of 150 Valleys,
and one of these valleys runs east to west in an area called Lower Engadine. There, the tiny village of Guarda rests atop the sharp ledge of a steep hill high above the valley floor, just miles from both the Austrian and Italian borders. There is only one sheer, winding road up to the little village, and it connects the one-room, whistle-stop train station below to the half-timbered houses above, a laborious 40-minute hike. There are almost no cars in the village, and farm animals greatly outnumber the human residents. Narrow cobblestone roads wind steeply up and between the white buildings, alongside water troughs and fenced gardens. The town ends abruptly, and the steep hill resumes, a meadow that rises to a thick pine forest that itself gives way to rocky cliffs that loom above the town that surveys the valley floor below and all who pass or approach. The villagers understand German, but among themselves speak Romansh, a language spoken by barely 1% of the 7.5 million Swiss and virtually no one else on Earth. At 4 a.m., a few snow flurries swirled around the little road that led from the valley floor up to Guarda. A lone man, dressed in thick jeans, a heavy coat, and a black knit cap, limped up the steep, winding switchback. A small backpack hung off his shoulders. 10 hours earlier, minutes after speaking with Don Fitzroy from a pink cell phone he'd snatched from the open purse of a staggeringly drunk female university student meandering alone on the sidewalk, Gentry found an outdoor clothing store in Budapest and purchased a full wardrobe, new from the bottom of his leather boots to the top of his black knit cap. Within an hour of leaving Sabot's building, he was boarding a bus at Nepliket bus terminal for the Hungarian border town of Hedeshalom. He climbed out of the bus a half mile from the border, walked north out of the village into a field, and turned left. There was no moon. He had a tactical flashlight in his pack but did not use it. Instead, he stumbled to the west, walked a mile on his cut feet, could feel the sting and the warm blood squish in his socks and between his cold toes. Finally, just before 8 in the evening, he crossed a field full of modern windmills and found himself in the Austrian border town of Nickelsdorf. He made it into the European Union. It was another mile walk, a limp, really, with a gunshot wound to the thigh and the injured feet and knees, before he found the road. He walked west with his thumb out for a few minutes. A trucker pulled over, but he was heading north and could not help. A second driver, and then a third, were also heading in the wrong direction. At 9:15, he was picked up by a Swiss businessman heading all the way to Zurich. Court told him his name was Jim. The businessman wanted to practice his English, and Court obliged. They talked about their lives and families on the trip across Austria. Court's story was 100% bullshit, but he was a pro. He sold the tale of the messy divorce back in Virginia, the lifelong desire to visit Europe, the mugging in Budapest that cost him his belongings, and his good fortune to still have his wallet and cash and passport, and a friend in eastern Switzerland who could put him up until he caught his plane back home the following week. As they drove through the night and talked, Court kept part of his focus on the side mirror, nonchalantly making sure he'd not been followed. He also, between the BS stories of places he'd never been and people he'd created out of whole cloth, kept in mind his task at hand. He tried to get his head around the events still to come in the next 30 hours. It was a Friday night. Traffic on the A1 was heavy, but the businessman's Audi was sleek and fast. They skirted to the north of Salzburg. Court offered to drive, and the Swiss businessman caught a couple of hours of sleep. The Audi turned onto the Engadiner Bundesstraße and crossed the northeastern border of Switzerland at 3 a.m. There was no customs control at the Swiss border, though Switzerland was not officially a member of the EU. The Swiss driver pulled into an all-night rest stop, insisting Jim simply must try Swiss beer and give his honest opinion. Court did so, gushed over the body and color and texture, threw in a few other accolades he'd once overheard in a Munich beer garden in reference to German brews, and this convinced the now smitten businessman to take Jim directly to his destination instead of dropping him off once their paths diverged. They took the 180 south and then the 27 west through a valley, though in the overcast night they could see nothing on either side of their headlights. Finally, in the burg of Lavin, Gentry picked a half-timbered house just off the main road and claimed it as his destination. Actually, by climbing out of the warm Audi here, Court was left with a 2-mile walk in the snow. But, he decided, should there be trouble waiting at his real objective, there was no reason for this nice fellow to suffer for his good deed.
Thanks for the lift. Auf Wiedersehen.
Court climbed out of the car and shook the gentleman's hand through the window. He stood in the road as he waved goodnight. As the taillights of the Audi rounded a corner in the distance, the gray man turned in the opposite direction and began walking westward through a gentle snowfall. He trudged along purposefully, but he was bone-tired